in the leisure spoken of bayou, which a freeman can always command, he has his talk out in peace, and, like ourselves, he wanders at will from one subject to another, and from a second to a third. If the fancy takes him, he begins again, as we are doing now, caring not whether his words are many or few, his only aim is to attain the truth. But the lawyer is always in a hurry, there is the water of the Clepsydra driving him on, and not allowing him to expatiate at will, and there is his adversary standing over him, enforcing his rights. The indictment, which in their phraseology is termed the affidavit, is recited at the time, and from this, he must not deviate. He is a servant, and is continually disputing about a fellow servant before his master, who is seated, and has the cause in his hands. The trial is never about some indifferent matter, but always concerns himself, and often the race is for his life. The consequence has been, that he has become keen and shrewd. He has learned how to flatter his master in word, and indulge him indeed, but his soul is small and unrighteous. His condition, which has been that of a slave from his youth upwards, has deprived him of growth and uprightness and independence. Dangers and fears, which were too much for his truth and honesty, came upon him in early years, when the tenderness of youth was unequal to them, and he has been driven into crooked ways. From the first he has practiced deception and retaliation, and has become stunted and warped, and so he has passed out of youth into manhood, having no soundness in him, and is now, as he thinks, a master in wisdom, such as the lawyer, Theodorus. Will you have the companion picture of the philosopher, who is of our brotherhood, or shall we return to the argument? Do not let us abuse the freedom of digression which we claim.
Nay, Socrates, not until we have finished what we are about, for you truly said that we belong to a brotherhood which is free, and are not the servants of the argument, but the argument is our servant, and must wait our leisure. Who is our judge, or where is the spectator having any right to censure or control us, as he might the poets?
Then, as this is your wish, I will describe the leaders, for there is no use in talking about the inferior sort. In the first place, the lords of philosophy have never, from their youth upwards, known their way to the agora, or the dicastery, or the council, or any other political assembly. They neither see nor hear the laws or decrees, as they are called, of the state written or recited. The eagerness of political societies in the attainment of offices, clubs, and banquets, and revels, and singing maidens, do not enter even into their dreams. Whether any event has turned out well or ill in the city, what disgrace may have descended to anyone from his ancestors, male or female, are matters of which the philosopher no more knows than he can tell. As they say, how many pints are contained in the ocean? Neither is he conscious of his ignorance, for he does not hold aloof in order that he may gain a reputation, but the truth is, that the outer form of him only is in the city. His mind, disdaining the littlenesses and nothingnesses of human things, is flying all abroad as Pindar says, measuring earth and heaven and the things which are under and on the earth, and above the heaven, interrogating the whole nature of each and all in their entirety, but not condescending to anything which is within reach.
What do you mean, Socrates?
I will illustrate my meaning, Theodorus, by the jest which the clever witty Thracian handmaid is said to have made about Thales, when he fell into a well as he was looking up at the stars. She said that he was so eager to know what was going on in heaven, that he could not see what was before his feet. This is a jest which is equally applicable to all philosophers, for the philosopher is wholly unacquainted with his next-door neighbor. He is ignorant, not only of what he is doing, but he hardly knows whether he is a man or an animal. He is searching into the essence of man, and busy in inquiring what belongs to such a nature to do, or suffer different from any other. I think that you understand me, Theodorus.
I do, and what you say is true.
And thus, my friend, on every occasion, private as well as public, as I said at first, when he appears in a law court, or in any place in which he has to speak of things which are at his feet, and before his eyes, he is the jest, not only of Thracian handmaids, but of the general herd, tumbling into wells and every sort of disaster through his inexperience. His awkwardness is fearful, and gives the impression of imbecility. When he is reviled, he has nothing personal to say in answer to the civilities of his adversaries, for he knows no scandals of anyone, and they do not interest him, and therefore he is laughed at for his sheepishness. And when others are being praised and glorified, in the simplicity of his heart he cannot help going into fits of laughter, so that he seems to be a downright idiot. When he hears a tyrant talking eulogized, He fancies that he is listening to the praises of some keeper of cattle, a swineherd, or shepherd, or perhaps a cowherd, who is congratulated on the quantity of milk which he squeezes from them, and he remarks that the creature whom they tend, and that of whom they squeeze the wealth, is of a less tractable and more insidious nature. Then, again, he observes that the great man is of necessity as ill-mannered and uneducated as any shepherd, for he has no leisure, and he is surrounded by a wall, which is his mountain pen. Hearing of enormous landed proprietors of 10,000 acres and more, our philosopher deems this to be a trifle, because he has been accustomed to think of the whole earth, and when they sing the praises of family, and say that someone is a gentleman, because he can show 7 generations of wealthy ancestors, he thinks that their sentiments only betray a dull and narrow vision in those who utter them, and who are not educated enough to look at the whole, nor to consider that every man has had thousands and ten thousands of progenitors, and among them have been rich and poor, kings and slaves, Hellenes and barbarians, innumerable. And when people pride themselves on having a pedigree of 25 ancestors, which goes back to Heracles, the son of Amphitryon, he cannot understand their poverty of ideas. Why are they unable to calculate that Amphitryon had a 25th ancestor, who might have been anybody, and was such as fortune made him, and he had a 50th, and so on? He amuses himself with the notion that they cannot count, and thinks that a little arithmetic would have got rid of their senseless vanity. Now, in all these cases our philosopher is derided by the vulgar, partly because he is thought to despise them, and also because he is ignorant of what is before him, and always at a loss.
That is very true, Socrates.
But, oh my friend, when he draws the other into upper air, and gets him out of his pleas, and rejoinders into the contemplation of justice and injustice in their own nature, and in their difference from one another, and from all other things, or from the commonplaces about the happiness of a king, or of a rich man to the consideration of government, and of human happiness and misery in general, what they are, and how a man is to attain the one and avoid the other, when that narrow, keen, little legal mind is called to account about all this, he gives the philosopher his revenge, for dizzied by the height at which he is hanging, whence he looks down into space, which is a strange experience to him, he being dismayed, and lost, and stammering broken words, is laughed at, not by Thracian handmaidens or any other uneducated persons, for they have no eye for the situation, but by every man who has not been brought up a slave. Such are the two characters, Theodorus, the one of the freeman, who has been trained in liberty and leisure, whom you call the philosopher. Him we cannot blame, because he appears simple, and of no account, when he has to perform some menial task, such as packing up bedclothes, or flavoring a sauce or fawning speech. The other character is that of the man who is able to do all this kind of service smartly and neatly, but knows not how to wear his cloak like a gentleman. Still less with the music of discourse can he hymn the true life right which is lived by immortals or men blessed of heaven.
If you could only persuade everybody, Socrates, as you do me, of the truth of your words, there would be more peace, and fewer evils among men.
Evils, Theodorus, can never pass away, for there must always remain something which is antagonistic to good. Having no place among the gods in heaven, of necessity they hover around the mortal nature, and this earthly sphere. Wherefore we ought to fly away from earth to heaven as quickly as we can, and to fly away is to become like God, as far as this is possible, and to become like Him is to become holy, just, and wise. But, oh my friend, you cannot easily convince mankind that they should pursue virtue or avoid vice, not merely in order that a man may seem to be good, which is the reason given by the world, and in my judgment, is only a repetition of an old wives' fable. Whereas, the truth is that God is never in any way unrighteous, He is perfect righteousness, and he of us who is the most righteous is most like Him. Herein is seen the true cleverness of a man, and also his nothingness and want of manhood, for to know this is true wisdom and virtue, and ignorance of this is manifest folly and vice. All other kinds of wisdom or cleverness, which seem only, such as the wisdom of politicians, or the wisdom of the arts, are coarse and vulgar. The unrighteous man, or the sayer and doer of unholy things, had far better not be encouraged in the illusion that his roguery is clever, for men glory in their shame. They fancy that they hear others saying of them, these are not mere good-for-nothing persons, mere burdens of the earth, but such as men should be who mean to dwell safely in a state. Let us tell them that they are all the more truly what they do not think they are because they do not know it, for they do not know the penalty of injustice, which above all things they ought to know, not stripes and death, as they suppose, which evildoers often escape, but a penalty which cannot be escaped.
What is that?
There are two patterns eternally set before them, the one blessed and divine, the other godless and wretched, but they do not see them, or perceive that in their utter folly and infatuation they are growing like the one and unlike the other, by reason of their evil deeds, and the penalty is, that they lead a life answering to the pattern which they are growing like, and if we tell them, that unless they depart from their cunning, the place of innocence will not receive them after death, and that here on earth, they will live ever in the likeness of their own evil selves, and with evil friends, when they hear this, they in their superior cunning will seem to be listening to the talk of idiots.
Very true, Socrates.
Too true, my friend. As I well know, there is, however, one peculiarity in their case. When they begin to reason in private about their dislike of philosophy, if they have the courage to hear the argument out, and do not run away, they grow at last strangely discontented with themselves. Their rhetoric fades away, and they become helpless as children. These, however, are digressions from which we must now desist, or they will overflow and drown the original argument, to which, if you please, we will now return.
For my part, Socrates, I would rather have the digressions, for at my age I find them easier to follow. But if you wish, let us go back to the argument.
Had we not reached the point at which the partisans of the perpetual flux, who say that things are as they seem to each one, were confidently maintaining that the ordinances which the state commanded and thought just, were just to the state which imposed them, while they were in force, this was especially asserted of justice. But as to the good, no one had any longer the hardihood to contend of any ordinances which the state thought and enacted to be good that these, while they were in force, were really good. He who said so would be playing with the name good, and would not touch the real question. It would be a mockery, would it not?
Certainly it would.
He ought not to speak of the name, but of the thing which is contemplated under the name.
Right.
Whatever be the term used, the good or expedient is the aim of legislation, and as far as she has an opinion, the state imposes all laws with a view to the greatest expediency. Can legislation have any other aim?
Certainly not.
But is the aim attained always? Do not mistakes often happen?
Yes, I think that there are mistakes.
The possibility of error will be more distinctly recognized if we put the question in reference to the whole class under which the good or expedient falls. That whole class has to do with the future, and laws are passed under the idea that they will be useful in after time, which, in other words, is the future.
Very true.
Suppose now that we ask Protagoras, or one of his disciples, a question. Oh, Protagoras, we will say to him, man is, as you declare, the measure of all things, white, heavy, light. Of all such things he is the judge, for he has the criterion of them in himself, and when he thinks that things are such as he experiences them to be, he thinks what is and is true to himself, is it not so?
Yes.
And do you extend your doctrine, Protagoras, as we shall further say, to the future as well as to the present, and has he the criterion not only of what in his opinion is but of what will be, and do things always happen to him as he expected? For example, take the case of heat, when an ordinary man thinks that he is going to have a fever, and that this kind of heat is coming on, and another person, who is a physician, thinks the contrary, whose opinion is likely to prove right, or are they both right? He will have a heat and fever in his own judgment, and not have a fever in the physician's judgment.
How ludicrous.
And the winner grower, if I am not mistaken, is a better judge of the sweetness or dryness of the vintage which is not yet gathered than the harp player.
Certainly.
And in musical composition the musician will know better than the training master what the training master himself will hereafter think harmonious or the reverse.
Of course.
And the cook will be a better judge than the guest, who is not a cook, of the pleasure to be derived from the dinner which is in preparation. For a present or past pleasure we are not as yet arguing, but can we say that everyone will be to himself the best judge of the pleasure which will seem to be and will be to him in the future? Nay, would not you, Protagoras, better guess which arguments in a court would convince any one of us than the ordinary man?
Certainly, Socrates. He used to profess in the strongest manner that he was the superior of all men in this respect.
To be sure, friend, who would have paid a large sum for the privilege of talking to him, if he had really persuaded his visitors that neither a prophet nor any other man was better able to judge what will be and seem to be in the future than everyone could for himself?
who indeed,
and legislation and expediency are all concerned with the future, and everyone will admit that states, in passing laws, must often fail of their highest interests.
Quite true.
Then we may fairly argue against your master, that he must admit one man to be wiser than another, and that the wiser is a measure. But I, who know nothing, am not at all obliged to accept the honor which the advocate of Protagoras was just now forcing upon me, whether I would or not, of being a measure of anything.
That is the best refutation of him, Socrates, although he is also caught when he ascribes truth to the opinions of others, who give the lie direct to his own opinion.
There are many ways, Theodorus, in which the doctrine, that every opinion of every man, is true may be refuted, but there is more difficulty in proving, that states of feeling, which are present to a man, and out of which arise sensations and opinions in accordance with them, are also untrue, and very likely I have been talking nonsense about them, for they may be unassailable, and those who say, that there is clear evidence of them, and that they are matters of knowledge, may probably be right, in which case our friend Theaetetus was not so far from the mark, when he identified perception and knowledge, and therefore let us draw nearer, as the advocate of Protagoras desires, and give the truth of the universal flux a ring. Is the theory sound or not? At any rate, no small war is raging about it, and there are combatants, not a few.
No small war, indeed, for an Ionia the sect makes rapid strides. The disciples of Heraclitus are most energetic upholders of the doctrine.
Then we are the more bound, my dear Theodorus, to examine the question from the foundation as it is set forth by themselves.
Certainly we are, about these speculations of Heraclitus, which, as you say, are as old as Homer, or even older still. The Ephesians themselves, who profess to know them, are downright mad, and you cannot talk with them on the subject, for, in accordance with their textbooks, they are always in motion. But as for dwelling upon an argument, or a question, and quietly asking, and answering in turn, they can no more do so than they can fly, or rather. The determination of these fellows not to have a particle of rest in them is more than the utmost powers of negation can express. If you ask any of them a question, he will produce, as from a quiver, sayings brief and dark, and shoot them at you. And if you inquire the reason of what he has said, you will be hit by some other newfangled word, and will make no way with any of them, nor they with one another. Their great care is not to allow of any settled principle, either in their arguments, or in their minds, conceiving, as I imagine, that any such principle would be stationary, for they are at war with the stationary, and do what they can to drive it out everywhere.
I suppose, Theodorus, that you have only seen them when they were fighting, and have never stayed with them in time of peace, for they are no friends of yours, and their peace doctrines are only communicated by them at leisure, as I imagine, to those disciples of theirs whom they want to make like themselves.
Disciples, my good sir, they have none. Men of their sort are not one another's disciples, but they grow up at their own sweet will, and get their inspiration anywhere, each of them saying of his neighbor, that he knows nothing. From these men, then, as I was going to remark, you will never get a reason, whether with their will, or without their will. We must take the question out of their hands, and make the analysis ourselves, as if we were doing a geometrical problem.
Quite right, too. But as touching the aforesaid problem, have we not heard from the ancients, who concealed their wisdom from the many and poetical figures, that Arsinus and Tethys, the origin of all things, are streams, and that nothing is at rest? And now the moderns, in their superior wisdom, have declared the same openly, that the cobbler too may hear and learn of them, and no longer foolishly imagine that some things are at rest and others in motion. Having learned that all is motion, he will duly honor his teachers. I had almost forgotten the opposite doctrine, Theodorus. Alone being remains unmoved, which is the name for the all. This is the language of Parmenides, Melissus, and their followers, who stoutly maintain that all being is one and self-contained, and has no place in which to move. What shall we do, friend, with all these people? For, advancing step by step, we have imperceptibly got between the combatants, and, unless we can protect our retreat, we shall pay the penalty of our rashness, like the players in the palestra who are caught upon the line, and are dragged different ways by the two parties. Therefore I think that we had better begin by considering those whom we first accosted, the river gods, and, if we find any truth in them, we will help them to pull us over, and try to get away from the others. But if the partisans of the whole appear to speak more truly, we will fly off from the party which would move the immovable to them, and if we find that neither of them have anything reasonable to say, we shall be in a ridiculous position, having so great a conceit of our own poor opinion, and rejecting that of ancient and famous men. O Theodorus, do you think that there is any use in proceeding when the danger is so great